This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs you with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at curology.com/Spotify. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required, cancel anytime.
This episode is brought to you by Dove. You use all the right skincare products for your face, but your body has been missing out. With new Dove Serum Body Wash, you can give your body the vitamin C glow it's been wanting, the hydration boost it's been craving, and the active skincare ingredients it deserves. It's time for your body care era. New Dove Serum Body Wash. Get Dove or get FOMO.
Welcome to the Olive Podcast. I'm Janine, Olive's deputy editor and podcast host, and each episode I'll be catching up with chefs, cookery writers and characters from the food scene in Britain and beyond. Join us each week to expand your food knowledge as our guests share 10 things we need to know about the specialist subject. And do listen out for our effortless bonus episodes where they also reveal their top cooking cheats, hacks and shortcuts. I'm delighted to welcome Amy Newsome to the podcast today. Amy is a horticulturist and garden designer, food writer and beekeeper based in London. Her new book, Honey, Recipes from a Beekeeper's Kitchen, is a celebration of this magical ingredient and brings together a huge amount of expert knowledge, stories and advice along some lovely creative recipes to make at home. Welcome, Amy. Thanks for coming to chat to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I believe you've been at the Chelsea Flower Show all week.
Yes, in complete coincidence, I've actually been working on building a Chelsea Main Avenue show garden, which is celebrating insects, all about insects.
Amazing. I can't wait to see that one. I'm going to check it out on TV later. So before we take a deep dive into all things honey, could you share a bit about your journey and your inspiration for writing the book?
So I'm a gardener and garden designer, as well as a sort of a cook and a beekeeper. And I changed careers into all of those things at once, because my mental health was dipping from working in an office job in central London. And I started growing in my back garden and getting into bees. And it just made me feel so much better. So no matter how you felt about yourself, when you watch something grow that you've planted yourself, or when you're very slowly looking after the bees and watching them go about their daily lives, it just makes you feel like you can do some good in the world. Yeah. And so it kind of went from there.
Okay. So you went into beekeeping, gardening, and then gradually moved into that sort of garden design. I think you said earlier that you come from a family of garden designers. Is that right?
Well, I come from a family of gardeners. So I grew up with my granddad being a head greenkeeper and groundsman. So sitting on the back of big lawn rollers when I was a child. And then actually me and my mom, which unfortunately after my granddad passed away, but me and my mom both retrained as gardeners and garden designers at the same time. Then we looked into our family records, and it goes as far back as 5 generations. They were professional market growers.
So it's in your blood, basically.
Yeah.
And how did you come to write the book?
Well, I am a really, really keen home cook, and I got into growing and beekeeping because of how much I love food.
Yeah.
And that satisfaction of going from the full, I guess you'd call it, bloom to plate.
Yeah.
if we go as far as gardening as well. But I just sort of got immediately interested in how food is made, getting really close to making really good quality food. And cooking with fresh produce. And so through the beekeeping and the growing and growing in kitchen gardens, I've worked in a couple of quite famous kitchen gardens, it sort of came out of there, really.
Did I read that you worked at Le Manoir?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the ultimate kitchen garden, isn't it?
It's so amazing. Beautiful. Yeah, it's, I think it's been, Le Manoir's been growing their own for about 35 years. And it's an amazingly slick operation in the kitchen gardens. And their work is absolutely incredible. And I volunteered there when I was first starting out. They were kind enough to let me run riot in their veg garden. And I didn't really look back from that.
I mean, the book's amazing because it's not... it's not just a celebration of honey and the recipes that you can use honey for, but you also go through like the beekeeper's honey varietals, you know, lots of information about gardening and bees. And we'll be touching on that as we go through the podcast. But let's jump in with the source of honey, the honeybee, which sadly is in decline, he said.
Well, the honeybee itself is actually not in decline.
Okay.
It's, I mean, it suffers from many pests and diseases, which as a sort of beekeeping community, we're doing our best to help with. But actually what's in decline is the over 250 species of wild bee that we have
in the
UK.
Okay.
So when we talk about saving the bees, we should really be thinking about our wild bees, because honeybees are bred livestock and people look after them.
Oh, yeah, of course. So you're kind of keeping them alive, basically, or keeping them going.
And then a lot... unfortunately, sort of, you know, when, as with many different industries and pastimes, people got very excited about beekeeping quite a few years ago, and it became really popular, especially in cities. And now we've realised that it really grew very unsustainably. And so the move now is sustainable beekeeping, so much smaller scale, so there's enough forage to go around, but also so that we're not impacting our wild species.
So is that because, you know, in practical terms, the bees need to go... to go and to be able to find plants to get the nectar from to make honey? But so if there's too many bees, there just isn't enough to sustain them.
Yeah, exactly. And also, when you introduce a honeybee hive into a local environment, that's about sort of anywhere upwards of 30,000 bees in one go. Whereas a lot of different species of wild bees just live on their own or a really small group. So it has quite a big impact on the ecosystem and the available nectar and flowers. So we need to be planting as many plants for bees and other pollinators as possible, but also being quite careful to... introduce honeybees in a very sensitive way to the environment.
What kind of things can people plant at home?
Well, I think the important thing is to look at your garden and see what's not flowering. Do you have a few months of the year where something isn't flowering? And then look up something that flowers during that time so that these pollinators have got something to go for throughout the season. But in terms of specific plants, trees actually are really brilliant. If you can plant a small tree in your garden, the amount of flowers that produces just per one plant is really impactful. So something like a native hawthorn tree that's blooming at the moment all over, and they look absolutely beautiful. They really attract loads of bees, or apples and cherry trees. And then also looking at plants that work for different species of bees. So for example, bumblebees have longer tongues and they love to go for plants like foxgloves. So if you've got a slightly shady corner, growing a few foxgloves is great for bumblebees like the common carder bee.
I love that. Let's talk about beekeeping, the practice, because it's ancient, isn't it? But I read in your book that before we learned how to do it, there was a much more rustic method of gathering. Tell us about that. Tell us about wild honey hunting.
Yeah, so wild honey hunting is practiced still in communities all over the world today. The earliest evidence that we have, we think at the moment, is Neolithic, because there are cave paintings all over the world. Some of the most famous ones are in Spain. And it's where... honeybee colonies are living in the wild. Often it's in slightly warmer climates, where it's Apis dorsata, the Asian honeybee, and they build these huge honeycombs that just hang off precipices, if that's how you say it, really high up. And so these communities will gather some really tall ladders and climb up to get them, obviously with no beekeeping suits, as we often wear in Europe, and harvest the comb. And they'll eat also the grubs, the bee larva inside the cone is a great form of protein.
I mean, it sounds terrifying.
It does.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs you with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/Spotify. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required, cancel anytime.
This episode is brought to you by Dove. You use all the right skincare products for your face, but your body has been missing out. With new Dove Serum Body Wash, you can give your body the vitamin C glow it's been wanting, the hydration boost it's been craving, and the active skincare ingredients it deserves. It's time for your body care era. New Dove Serum Body Wash. Get Dove or get FOMO.
Can you take us through the honey-making process? How do the bees actually do it?
So honey itself is made from flower nectar, and flowers and plants produce nectar as a reward for pollination to attract bees to pollinate the flower so that the plants can reproduce. And the bees will drink the flower nectar straight out of the flower, depending on the species, long enough for their tongues, although some bees rob where they chew a hole in the side of the flower so that they can get in that way. And then through enzymes in their stomach, that starts a process that converts the flower nectar into honey, and then it gets it's called stropping, but it's which is a nice term for regurgitating many times between bees to further reduce the moisture content, and as the enzymatic process continues, it's then deposited into little hexagonal cells and further evaporated down, and then it becomes honey.
You've obviously done a huge amount of like research and, you know, looking into the whole beekeeping world. How did you, when you started, how much did you know about it? Was it something that you've just gradually learnt more of?
Yeah, I'm a massive nerd. Yeah. So one of the reasons why I've got a bit of a multi-hyphenate career at the moment is because I just get really interested in different things and then want to do them all at the same time. And then they end up inspiring each other. So with beekeeping, I bought a few books on it and then joined my local beekeeping association and went from there in terms of doing their beginner's training. And I was completely hooked because the first time you open a beehive, you sort of, from the movies or popular media, you expect it to be sort of a raging inferno of insects that come up off the roof. And that's not what happens. Yeah. You just see these very gentle insects going about their daily business, and then you gently sort of inspect them and then take the honey.
Amazing. Let's talk a little bit more about the honey. You've got a lovely phrase, blossom terroir, to describe the varieties of honey. And you say it's very similar to wine in that sense. Tell us a bit about that.
So it sounds fairly pretentious, I think, to use the phrase blossom terroir, but I'm really passionate about it because good honey, which to me means minimally processed honey, small batch honey, does taste of the landscape exactly where it's from, because bees forage within 1 to 3 miles around their hives, and each flower nectar tastes different. So depending on the plants that are growing around a beehive, the resulting honey will taste different if it hasn't been overly processed. And unfortunately, if you go in a supermarket and buy the cheapest honey off the shelf, it will have been processed usually from multiple countries, multiple nations, and quite highly sort of blended and also heated as well, often pasteurized. And unfortunately, this kills all of those local flavors. So going for a small batch good honey, you get those very distinctive plant flavors.
Yeah. And you mentioned the British Beekeepers Association before, because I saw that website address in your book and went on it to find out if I had any local beekeepers in North London, and I do. And I think that's a great shout for people, that they can go on there, find people who are making it and possibly selling it, and you can actually have honey that's, you know, 2 minutes away from your door.
Yeah, I think it's a great way of supporting sort of local food production, and also is a great way of, if you are enthusiastic about beekeeping, beekeeping, but perhaps you live in an area where there's already quite a few honeybee hives and we wouldn't want to add more of them, then find your local beekeeping association, buy the local honey and get involved in their workshops instead. And that's one way that you can enjoy it. But yeah, certainly your local beekeeping associations are a great way to find your local honey.
Yeah. There's a lovely varietals decoder in the book where you talk about all the different types of honey you can get. Some of them are recognised, some of them a bit rarer. And you can actually pair those varietals with foods that they complement as well, can't you, in cooking?
Yeah, there's sort of the, I guess you could say that the number of different honey flavours is completely limitless because it's whatever is growing around beehives. And all over the world, you've got so many different landscapes and flora growing that you get this incredible range of flavours. So with the book, I decided to pair every recipe with a particular honey varietal or a adapted honey. So I have garlic fermented honey and home smoked honey, which are things that I like to mess around in the kitchen making, and then suddenly got very excited and paired them with a lot of things in the book. But yeah, so it's not to say that you need to go out and buy that very specific honey if you want to make that recipe, but it's an inspiration starting point to say, actually, you can pair all these really interesting honeys with lots of different foods, and there's something to go with every honey, no matter how sort of unexpectedly dark, rich and bitter it is. It might go really well in a cocktail.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Another fascinating thing you said is honey never goes off, because we think of food as something that's got a shelf life, don't we? But tell us why it doesn't go off.
Because the process that bees have put so much hard work into to make honey from flower nectar is partly to create a shelf-stable product. So they've put in all that work to make it naturally preserve. And part of that is that the enzyme reactions that happen in the bee's stomach mean that the resultant honey has these antimicrobial, antibacterial properties anyway, which is great for shelf storage, but also that moisture evaporation process.
Yeah.
If it was left as flower nectar, it would ferment. And that's a bit like how we make mead, the honey booze, is by mixing water with honey and then it ferments and becomes alcoholic, whereas bees are trying to stop fermentation in this case so that you can create something that stores. So handily, the bees have done all of that preserving for us, so we don't need to add any form of preservatives. Honey doesn't go off at all, but it may crystallise sooner or later, depending on the honey. And if you sort of have put your honey in a very moist environment, then it might start to ferment. But beyond that, it's quite limitless as to how long it can keep for.
Yeah, and crystallization does mean it's gone off. It's fine to use, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's annoying, and I completely understand how it's really
irritating.
Because
you can't drizzle it anymore.
Exactly.
You've got to
skip
it.
And suddenly you put your spoon in and it can bend your spoon sometimes. However, it's a very natural part of the process, and particularly with good honeys, they might crystallize sooner or later, and that's because of the proportion of fructose to glucose in the original flower nectar. So it's a completely natural part of the process. Yeah. As you say, you can just put it in a bowl of warm water and it will slowly loosen off. And it's something to kind of just respect that it's a natural ingredient. It changes over time. A bit like wine doesn't stay perfect forever. It does have a going off date.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about how to buy, as not everyone will have access to that lovely local honey. So what should we be looking for on the label if we are in a shop or a supermarket?
So unfortunately, at the moment in the UK, we're in a situation where honey only needs to say on it a blend of EU and non-EU honeys as sort of the bare minimum of where it comes from.
Okay.
And obviously, again, with the wine comparison, if you went into your local wine shop looking for red wine and all you got was a bank of red wine that didn't say anything about it other than a blend of EU and non-EU wines, you'd be pretty disappointed.
Yeah.
And it's those honeys that at the moment, unfortunately, are highly likely to be adulterated, because we're getting a lot of cheap honeys coming in from overseas with very obscure supply chains, and often there is sugar in that honey, either from being mixed into the honey or from being fed to the bees right before harvesting the honey. So it's gone through the bee's gut, but it's still not pure honey. So whilst that labelling issue is being resolved and we're campaigning for that, I'd really advise people to choose honeys that says very clearly where it's from, a very specific country, preferably much more local than that, a specific region, a specific type of honey, because then you will know that it's going to be, hopefully, 100% pure honey and really good honey.
And like all these things, if someone's shouting, because they don't have to put it on the label, if they're really shouting about where it's from, and all of those different details, it's probably a good honey.
Yeah, exactly. And honey is not cheap to produce unless you are producing it badly and unethically, yeah. like this, unfortunately, the honey that's coming in from overseas. So in the meantime, it's kind of one of those things where spend as much as you can afford and treat it as like a little special thing to have.
Yeah.
And like maybe swap out your flavours. So once you've got to the end of one flavour of honey jar, yeah. then try a different one. And it, don't expect it to be your kind of mainstream sweetener that you can buy super cheaply yeah. because it's not good for the industry or the bees.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we have an idea in our head of the flavour profile of honey and honey-flavoured things. But actually, as you've been saying, honey's got so many different shades of flavour. So yeah, look out for those local ones or those specialist ones. Lastly, let's talk a bit about cooking, because there are tons of recipes in the book and some best practices, because we don't want to kill that flavour with too much heat, do we?
Yeah, depending on how you're cooking with honey, what I would usually say to do is add it as late as you can in the cooking process. Yeah. Because in the making of good honey from a beekeeper extracting from a beehive point of view, we try not to heat it at all because you preserve as many floral aromas as possible. So the same logic follows into cooking, although that doesn't mean that you can't put honey in a cake and it tastes amazing. I've tried and there are several recipes in the book as a result. But there's a few things to just bear in mind when you are baking with honey, for okay. example, is that, again, because of that fructose to glucose ratio in flower nectar compared to baking with regular sugar, honey browns quicker, it caramelizes quicker. So you've got to slightly adjust your oven time so that your cake doesn't overly yeah. brown, but you do get this wonderful, much more complex flavour than you would if you were baking with white sugar, for yeah. example. And sometimes my recipes will still have white sugar in there as a baseline stable yeah. sweetness, and then honey as an extra layer of complexity on top of that. So you get the best of both worlds in your baking. And also because good honey is expensive, yeah. you know, putting a whole jar into a cake is quite a luxurious act, I think.
Yeah, there's quite a funny story in the book about you trying to make meringue from honey.
I am so stubborn and I love meringues. When I say meringue, I mean the pavlovas that you make yeah. in your oven that have a crunchy top, not yeah. the ones that you need to blow torch. For me, okay. that's not a meringue. But so I love making pavlova, and so I was damned if I wasn't going to be able to put a honey pavlova into the book. However, obviously, as many pastry chefs will know, I am not a pastry chef. I had to go on this journey myself. But meringues are sort of, they're very, temperamental, shall
yeah,
we say.
Really...
Yeah, and moisture content is absolutely key. Yeah. And the way that sugar and moisture behaves is key. And meringues are sort of done and dusted. And obviously, I was trying to fiddle with them. But I found when I was making meringues, I tried to put in all honey. And I ended up creating something that was like a really good biodegradable version of Floristry Oasis. And it tasted absolutely vile, but it probably would absolutely save the floristry industry in terms of sustainability, but I would not recommend it. However, I did get to a result of using just a little bit of a really nice floral honey, and it created a really great meringue.
So that's exactly what you said before, using sugar for the bulk of it, but then adding your honey as the flavour
exactly.
ingredient.
Yeah, I should have known at the beginning, actually, that quality rather than quantity was the way to go.
And then tell us about fermenting with honey, because I know you're a huge fan of that. How does that work?
So it works by basically sort of undoing some of the work that those bees did in really trying to create a honey that's got a moisture content low enough to store.
Right.
So you add moisture back into it. So you can do that in various ways. And if you, depending on the honey flavour that you want to create. So, for example, I love cooking savoury recipes, obviously, with garlic fermented honey.
Yeah.
And when you want to create a flavoured fermented honey, it's the moisture in what you add that then ferments the honey itself.
Oh, so you
and
put
they
the flavour back in, so they're kind of...
So if you put like lots of raw garlic cloves,
yeah.
like lightly smashed into a jar of honey, honey is hygroscopic, so it will draw moisture out of the atmosphere or anything that it comes into contact with. So it draws the moisture out of the garlic, and in turn that ferments the honey, and then it infuses with the garlic flavour, and you get this amazing, very savoury fermented garlic honey, which is really good for cooking
with. It sounds absolutely delicious. And you mentioned drinks before. What kind of drinks do you use honey in?
I really like making cocktails at home. I really took after sort of the Stanley Tucci COVID lockdown cocktail hour trend. I got really into it. But I find cocktails are a great medium for really characterful honeys.
Yeah.
So something like a chestnut honey or an oak honey, which... sounds a bit strange because people think, okay, they don't have really big sherry flowers yeah. that produce nectar, but bees also drink the honeydew, which is what aphids produce when they feed on trees. So they'll feed on the tree sap, they'll produce honeydew. Bees farm that, and that makes forest honeys, as the category is called. And they tend to be really rich and dark and bitter in flavour. So they're really good for cocktails, because if you're pairing like oak honey with a whiskey, for example, that's really interesting, because you often use sugar syrup or gum in cocktail making.
Yeah.
Why not use honey? It's already liquid and it's got so many more floral aromas than gum does. And so it's a really great way to kind of change things around. So you could make like a bee's knees cocktail with honey as well. Or I like to make a sesame old-fashioned cocktail. Yeah. I'm just obsessed with sesame. It's in a lot of recipes in the book.
They sound great. Pick a couple of favourite recipes from the book for me.
In terms of sheer popularity and what I get asked to make a lot, one of them is my double plum ribs recipe, which is kind of a classic sort of baby back ribs vibe. The pork goes super tender, it melts off the bone, and it was something that when we shot the photography for the book, it just disappeared in a scratch without even asking permission to eat the dish after shooting. It just disappeared and the clean bones were left. So it was a sign of it had gone down really well. And it's called double plum because it's got fresh plums in, but it's also got umeboshi, which is fermented Japanese plum paste. So you get this like really savoury, fruity, jammy slow cooked rib recipe.
Lovely.
Which is really great. And then what else would I go for? I'm actually going to pick a guest recipe because it's so iconic and so important to, I would say, sort of contemporary cooking culture, which is Michelle Polzin, who is a Californian pastry chef.
Yeah.
And she used to run the iconic 20th Century Cafe in San Francisco, really known for her amazing baking and her amazing cakes. She's famous for a 10-layer honey cake.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a take on an Austrian layered cake.
I've had Russian honey cake.
Yes.
I'm sure it's the same one.
Exactly.
Really thin sponges with the cream in between.
So there are variants of that cake from Russia through to Ukraine,
lovely,
Austria. And Michelle's version slightly burns the honey, which I usually would not countenance, but it tastes incredible in this case. And I have huge respect for Michelle's
work.
You
allowed it.
Yeah, well, I allowed it. And also she allowed me to use the recipe, which is really great. So we've popped Michelle's honey cake into the book. And I'm super proud of it because it's absolutely delicious. And then I've done a bit of a spin-off of that in the sense of there's a great coffee and walnut version. So gone for a sort of a British tea time classic spin on Michelle's Californian cake, and then also using some of that burnt honey and the dulce de leche that goes into the cake as well to make a really great no churn ice cream.
Okay, I'm completely starving now, even though I've already had my lunch. And just to recap, if people want to buy the book, it's out now and it's called Honey Recipes from a Beekeeper's Kitchen. But thank you so much for coming to chat to us today, Amy. If people want to keep in touch with you, is Instagram the best place?
Yeah, follow me on Instagram, The Botanical Beekeeper.
So it's at The Botanical Beekeeper. Brilliant. Thanks again for coming to chat to us, Amy. It's been brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Olive Podcast. For recipes and more information, head to olivemagazine.com. Do remember to listen out for our effortless bonus episodes where our guests reveal their best cooking cheats, hacks and shortcuts. And don't forget to subscribe at iTunes, Acast, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.